permanently installed. So they're going to open up like an alligator, it looks like, two halves, and then the payload will take off, do its job, communication satellite, whatever they're launching. And the fairings will close back up, back through the atmosphere. These dirty engines on the circumference of this vehicle, it'll come protected from burning up, and hopefully it will land back on Earth, and then all reusable. So I thought that was pretty good. It's called a Stoke. Let me drop it. And we'll see how it does. Right now, the test I saw with this thing taking off has 15 chambers. So it looks like it has 15 rockets, but essentially it's one big rocket on the inside. They just have a lot of different thrust belts sticking out of the thing. That's quite common. You see that with the Atlas V. They right now they launched the Atlas V with the RD-180 engines from Russia, and eventually, of course, they're running out of them. And they're going to do away with the Atlas V anyway, and that's going to be replaced by the Vulcan rocket. But the Atlas V, when you see two of these big bells, cones sticking out of the bottom. Not really two engines. It's one big RD-180 engine, and it just has two chambers, and they feed both chambers. That's how they get their thrust. Well, this one's got 30. we'll have 30 right now, 15. We'll see. Any comments? WS2M. Okay. Back to manned space flight anyway. This Wednesday, I think it's Wednesday, the 27th, today's the 24th, yeah, this Wednesday, an astronaut is coming back with two Russians, and his name is Frank Rubio, and we've covered him many, many times on the set. Went up over a year ago in a Soyuz rocket. Everything's fine. Docked with the International Space Station, him and his crew, three people are supposed to stay for roughly 6 months. Supposed to get back in their Soyuz vehicle, come back to Earth. It was landed in Kazakhstan, and then they go on a separate way after that. Two Russians get picked up, sent back to Star City near Moscow to get deprogrammed, and then the American, whoever it might be, in this case Frank Rubio, he would be picked up by a NASA Gulfstream jet and flown back to the United States. 6 months later, that's what's supposed to happen. Well, this thing took a little bit longer, like another 6 months longer. And the reason for that is the Soyuz, that one, they went up and docked with the International Space Station. Everything's fine. As the weeks and months went by, apparently some kind of little micrometeorite, as they believe, hit the one of the lines, cooling lines on the Soyuz vehicle, which started to let cooling fluid fly out of the out of it. And they have actual video of these things. You can see that coming out of the vehicle. It wasn't fuel, but it was cooling lines. Probably, I guess, ammonia. Anyway, let me drop it. That Soyuz spacecraft was now deemed not flyable by humans. Maybe we could get it back without humans, but why not put people in, I think. If that thing overheats, we could lose a crew. So what they decided to do was send up a brand new spacecraft, unmanned, to dock with the International Space Station. But one of the things they wanted to do is they had to get rid of this thing. So they left it attached to this space station for 6 months because, God forbid, they needed to get out of it, out of the space station. If it got hit by an asteroid, if there was a fire, they would have still used this vehicle to get out and gamble to get back to Earth. But they didn't have to do that. They sent a brand new vehicle, and then this one went back to Kazakhstan through the atmosphere. Before it goes through, there's three parts of the Soyuz spacecraft. there's the descent module, which the crew of three usually returns in, and then there's the orbital module that attaches to the front of the Soyuz spacecraft, and then there's the service module that's attached to the tail end of the spacecraft. So, three main sections. So what they do is, right before they re-enter the atmosphere, both sections, all three sections separate at the same time. The service module disconnects, and the orbital module disconnects. That leaves the descent module. That comes back down through the atmosphere. And it worked out. I mean, that actually came through the atmosphere. They probably would have been able to make it. But because of this, the thing involved was complications with crews that were there, and some people coming up, some people coming down. And to make a long story short, Frank Rubio is now stuck on his spacecraft for a whole year. And now it's just over a year. I think they said 374 days. They'll be coming back Wednesday, which is interesting. I did see an interview with them from the space station. And they asked him, you know, would you have done this if there was an accident, a problem with your spacecraft? Would you have, you know, decided, you know, say they said stay on the space station before you launch? He says, when he was training, he says, no, because of family reasons and this and that, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I mean, if that was the mission and I was training for it, then that's something else. But he would have turned it down. You know, so he's making it sound like it's a long haul. You know, he had things to do. I mean, they keep them busy up there day after day. They live on Greenwich Mean Time, what we call UTC time. They live on that on a regular basis. It's always something to do, including three spacewalks. He did do three spacewalks. So that was pretty good, I'm sure he's going to be very happy to get back home to his family, and we'll see how the flight back down to Kazakhstan goes on Wednesday. This is WSLN for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Nothing heard. Somebody has a comment. Another mission I'm looking forward to eventually landing, I think probably within a month or so. I'm not sure. Anyway, this one will be a landing on the moon. And this one was launched by Japan. So we'll see how this one goes. It's called the SLIM mission, the Smart Lander for Investigating the Moon. SLIM was launched with payloads from Japan. One was the telescope that's going to receive, it's going to look at X-rays coming through space, similar to the Chandra Space Telescope, which was launched in, 1999, by the shuttle, which is still functioning by the United States. But this one was launched by Japan, and that, from what I heard, the telescope is doing good. But the other payload was this thing, SLIM, Smart Lander for Investigating the Moon, they call it. And the idea of this is to try to land precisely on the moon. That's their goal, completely autonomous. And to do that, they're actually still in orbit around the Earth. Each time they come to perigee, they ignite their engine again, and it gives them a little bit more push, and eventually they will break free of the atmosphere of the orbit of Earth. And then as time goes on, they'll be able to get caught up into the gravitational well of the moon. But before they do that, they're going to go well past the moon. They're just going to keep on going past the moon. I think this one's going to be, I haven't looked it up yet, but I think it's going to be like 700,000 miles, like twice the distance of the moon past the moon. And eventually they're going to come down, they're going to slow down to a crawl, and then start coming back toward the moon, and eventually enter orbit around the moon that way. It saves on fuel when they do that. You know, they're using orbital mechanics to do that. There's no crew on board, so they don't have to worry. It's going to take months on end to do that. If there's a crew like Artemis, you know, then you want to get there as fast as possible. It would be like 3.5 days before they get into orbit around the moon. And then and that's why the next mission, next crewed Artemis mission, will be only about 10 days going to the moon and back. But an unmanned mission that we just had at the end of last year, 25 days. But so eventually it'll get caught, this slim will get caught up at the moon, and eventually they will try to land it in a location. I think it's an equatorial spot on the moon, one particular spot that they're aiming for. And the idea behind this is to try to accurately land. They want to land within 300 feet of a certain location, completely autonomously. Far enough to land on the moon, but they're going to try to do that accurately. And I don't know why they're making such a big deal out of it. Well, I can see Japan making a big deal out of it. It's a big deal for them. They haven't landed anything successfully on the moon yet, so it's a big deal for them. You know, we've landed not only six Apollo missions on the moon, we've landed half a dozen Surveyor missions also landed on the moon. Well, one of those Surveyor missions was the Surveyor 3, and it was sitting in a certain location on the moon. When they sent Apollo 12 up after 11 with Conrad and Bing, their goal was to land right as close as they can to the Surveyor 3 vehicle. And Pete Conrad, who was the commander, he controlled it at the very end. And he eventually, toward the end, he grabs the stick and he's able to move it one way or the other. By the way, he's not controlling the jets on the, or the rockets on the spacecraft when he's doing that. When he's moving his hand controller, he's moving it. He's telling the computer, "I want to go to a different position." The computer then figures that out and eventually lands in that spot. Well, he landed roughly around 300 feet away from the Surveyor. And what they did is when they did a spacewalk, Pete Conrad and Alan Bean walked all the way to Surveyor. And there's pictures of them, you know, in front of the, one at a time, of course, somebody else had a camera. One of them always had a camera. We'd take a picture of Conrad, you know, on the moon near Surveyor. And they actually ripped the camera off. They tried to get the camera off, but it was jammed, and they actually broke the little bracket that was attached to it, and they eventually brought that camera back, a Halcyon camera, all the way back to Earth. So, you know, we've done that already, so I'm not too sure what the exact goal or what it is. Concentrating on this. They're making a big deal out of landing very, you know, a precise spot on the moon, which is good, you know. I mean, it's all autonomously. Maybe that's the idea. Well, most of our, all of our moon missions were mostly autonomous, and, you know, they might adjust it a little bit at a time, at the very end. But this one here, it's got radar on board, you know, to see how far it is. It also has a laser altimeter. One of the interesting things it does have is something similar to what we had on Perseverance when it landed on Mars. It's got cameras on board, and it's going to take a picture of the surface of the moon. All that data, all those pictures are programmed into in this case, the SLIM lander. So it will know exactly what crater it's near, exactly where it is as it's coming down. And in real time, it's going to decide, okay, here's a picture. It's going to take like 30 pictures a second. But each time it takes a picture, the computer will analyze it and send that data to the thrusters, and hopefully this thing lands where it's supposed to land. So that'd be pretty cool. They call that the SLIM mission. We'll see when. So whenever that thing comes up for landing, I'll bring that up on the net. We'll see how Japan does. They'll join other countries, you know, naturally the United States, Russia, China, now India, and now eventually Japan in landing something on the moon. Any comments? This is WS2N for the space. portion of the TechNet.
WB2BXL.
Hello again, Frank. Yes. WB2BXL, back to you.
Yeah, very good. I feel like I'm the only one on here this evening besides you. Anyway, when the pieces of the Voyager, probably never bring that one back, unless Star Trek does in a couple of centuries. When pieces of Surveyor were brought back, I believe some bacteria that was on it when it departed Earth was found to still be there, and if I remember correctly, researchers were able to reanimate it and discovered the bacteria can actually survive in suspended animation in space. If I remember the story correctly, if I have it completely wrong, you know, say so, because I don't want to spread rumors here. And I believe that experiment was an intentional experiment similar to that has been tried on the space station, and that has been duplicated. So quite a bit apparently was accomplished by bringing back the Surveyor. Not sure, as you say, what they want to accomplish with this. The goal with the next one is, other than to demonstrate that the mission can be done autonomously, perhaps. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. Naturally, of course, the Japan is dying to be able to join the group of countries that have successfully landed on the moon. Of course, that's their number one goal. But you know, to top it off and you know, to land precisely where they want to land is going to be even better. At one time I heard they wanted to land near one of those lava tubes. So maybe that's what they're shooting for. You know, the lava tubes, you know, that's the theory behind that. We've talked about that. They might go on for hundreds of feet or even miles under the ground of the moon. You'd be able to set up a town or a city underneath. Be protected from meteors and cosmic rays, you know, coming off the sun. But that camera that was brought back. All right, now I heard exactly the same story that you said, that they figured out. Originally, they thought, oh, maybe it's some kind of bacteria out of space. But of course, they said that can't be. So then they said they analyzed it and they figured out it was some kind of bacteria from humans, so somebody touched it. Now, the theory, like you said, is what I heard. It was touched before it went up. They figured out somebody must have touched it before it went up, and it survived all that. Now, I heard another story a few years back what it is they brought it back and they were going to examine it, you know, when they brought it back and somebody touched it at that time. So here's some bacteria that was put on after they landed. That might not be true. And I'll have to, you know, research that over and over again to try to confirm that from, you know, multiple sources, preferably NASA, you know, not the... I don't want to go to the conspiracy net or something. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, sorry about that. I accidentally swiped out the audio for a moment there. I think the lava tube thing is interesting. I think the idea is that the research station could be built in the lava tube. Well, we'd rather have this peaceful competition between nations than what's going on in Ukraine. That's for sure. And it looks like that situation is continuing to get even crazier. Go ahead, Paul. That was the B2BX.
Yeah, Frank. Very good. Well, we'll have to see. I can see see, if we knew for sure about these latitudes, you know, I would concentrate on nuclear fission, which they're working on. They're working on these units that could put out 10 kilowatts of power. You could have a whole bunch of these things sitting on the moon's surface and, you know, run them in series of parallel, whatever you want to do. And you could have, you know, three or four or five of these things putting out, you know, having some as a backup. And forget about the South Pole. South Pole is good, you know. They're gonna use the idea of is to get to the craters and utilize the possible ice that's down there, and you know, get it out, water and this and that. But I don't know. You know, that's important. I agree. But this lava tube thing really sounds good. I mean, you know, but you know, you have 14 days of night. So you definitely would need some kind of power system that's going to be able to keep people nice and toasty. Not only, you know, I mean, if you're going to live inside of a lava tube, you know, you're going to need that. And that, to me, that would be an ultimate goal, because you still got to live. You know, there's not going to, I don't think there's any lava tubes that I know of that are down on the South Pole. So that means living in habitats that you're going to have to build, probably inflate. There's a new system that they're thinking about, and, you know, inflate these living quarters on the moon and then put regolith now on top of it. I think I talked about this a week or two ago, where at one time they used to think you would need at least a meter thick of regolith to put on top of a living quarter to protect yourself from all the rays and, you know, the extra radiation. But now they because of India put a probe, the mist there into the surface, and they're able to figure out the temperature going down. They figured out that it gets, it's a highly insulating substance. You know, they thought the temperature was going to, you know, not drop that fast, you know, when they put this probe in, but, you know, only went a couple inches down, and the, you know, change in the temperature was dramatic. So now they think, well, maybe only 3 or 4 inches of this stuff is good enough to cover an inflatable habitat. And maybe that'll be good enough. Well, if that's okay, you know, and then the, of course, the South Pole is great, you know. But if you need equipment to put, you know, tons of material, you know, on top of a living quarters, that's going to be a problem. But if you only have to put a couple of inches, you know, maybe it's doable. We'll see as time goes on. Let me drop it and see if there's anybody with comments, including you, Frank. WS2N.
WB2BX. So, yeah, I've wondered if fishing is the way to go with this. I've spoken to a ham friend who's an engineer who's worked on solar systems, and I've wondered whether perhaps there's another, would be a better way to go about it, storing up the energy during the 2 weeks of daylight, either at supercaps or some combination of supercaps, nuclear batteries, fission, or some other method, and then sending it down during the night. The guy I spoke to thought it might be practical, but I couldn't talk him into submitting it for the, to working it out and submitting it to the NASA competition. I think he wanted projects that would make money for him faster. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't blame him. Yeah. How many solar cells, that, you know, we could figure that out, but how many solar cells would actually need, let's say, you know, going on the battery idea and, you know, having all these batteries, you know, the weight of these batteries, or could you manufacture the batteries, you know, out of the regolith that's on the moon? That would be good. And you have a massive amount of batteries, you know, thousands of them, you know. You know, we have that here on Earth, but they're trying to store power in batteries now, you know, around the country. you know, megawatt systems. But, you know, have that on the moon. But, you know, to power them, what are you going to have? You know, solar panels the size of, you know, five baseball stadiums or something. You know, what would you need to power these things? You know, wouldn't it be better to have vision systems producing 10 kilowatts, as many as you need, and then have these things powering up the batteries, you know, especially if these vision systems fail for any reason. You'd want the batteries to last long enough to get you through the 14-day night period, 14 Earth days. Very good, Frank. I don't blame him. You gotta have a good idea. You gotta make a good buck out of it. Okay, let me see. I just want to talk about Blue Origin for a minute. Hopefully one of these days they'll get their rocket off the ground. And I'm not talking about their new Shepard that they had problems with. Actually, they're planning on starting that up again. New Shepard is the one where they would launch up to 60 people into suborbital space, 62 miles up into space, separate from the booster. The booster would come back down, land vertically, reuse the spacecraft itself that comes down with a crew of six. They did that quite a few times, but then they launched an unmanned vehicle. They had some science equipment on board. The spacecraft separated, came back up through parachutes like it's supposed to, but the booster didn't make it. They've been investigating that since the end of last year. So they're thinking about restarting that. But one rocket I'm talking about that I'd like to see them get off the ground is the New Glenn, which is being developed by Blue Origin in Florida, being built down there. They have big pieces of it built already. They're running tests left and right. They build their own engines, the BE-4 engines, which are liquid methane, liquid oxygen engines, which are not only going to power the New Glenn vehicle, but eventually they're supposed to be powering the Vulcan engine, Vulcan rockets for Boeing and Lockheed that they're building. That's supposed to get off the ground by the end of this year, one of those launches. But New Glenn is supposed to be, you know, one of these things, you know, bigger than the as tall as the Saturn V, so almost in the Starship category. SpaceX is by building, you know, and it's all going to be reusable. And when I say all, right, the original plans were to have the booster reusable. And I'm sure that's the way it'll be in the beginning. But they call it the Javis program, and the Javis program is what Blue Origin is working on. They are working on a second stage. It's supposed to be reusable. I haven't seen any documents on this, YouTube or anything. But they are planning on eventually having a completely reusable vehicle on the large side. You know, the one I spoke about earlier, Stoke, that's a lot smaller. It's a large rocket, but it's nowhere near the size of a New Glenn. The New Glenn's supposed to have, I believe, 7 Vulcan rockets attached to the for the booster, and when it goes off, and I think multiple engines as well for the second stage. But there'll be BE-7 engines. They're liquid hydrogen and liquid methane. Same idea as what SpaceX is doing with Starship, but the same as well, oxygen and methane. We'll see. They have their launch complex pretty much built out in Florida, Launch Complex 36, they took over. And I've seen pictures of it. It looks like it's done to me. Big launch tower. Eventually, now these are going to also be eventually manned spacecraft. So eventually they'll have launch towers that people can go up in and board their spacecraft. A long way from doing that. But, I mean, a long-term goal, that's it. Jeff Bezos wants to set up factories in space. He thinks everything's going to be manufactured in space. And the other guy, Musk, he thinks we're all going to be living off another planet someday. But both guys with their high hopes. It's still good that they're pouring a ton of money into a space program like this. They've made some big strides. Any comments? WS2N. Okay. Anyway, by the way, Frank, there were some check-ins earlier, and I'm sure some people are listening. So, yeah. Very good. I just want to talk about the computers on board Perseverance rover on Mars. They're doing well. They multiple computers. The one article I read is showing how good the autonomous system is on Perseverance compared to all the older rovers that we've had up there. You know, we started off with Sojourner back in 1997. Sojourner was able to move a couple of inches, and it would stop, and then it would look around, and it would know its next move. You know, they set these rovers up where they could drive straight, unless there's a boulder or a crater in a way, and then they'll know to go left, right, which is the best way to do it. So it would take, like, Sojourner. By the way, Sojourner was the one that's as big as a microwave oven. And it would drive around, and it was a proof of concept vehicle. You know, it had the six wheels on it, had a bogey system. It really proved out excellent. So then when we went up with our next two vehicles, the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, to go roughly 1.5 feet, not inches, but 1.5 feet, and then put the brakes on, look around, say, okay. In other words, the guy on Earth would direct it. Say, I want this rover to go, 500 feet, during the day in one direction. Well, Spirit and Opportunity would try that, and they would go, 1.5 feet, stop, look around, okay, rock here, rock there, I'm going to go left, I'm going to go right. Well, everything's clear, I'm just going to keep going straight. And that's the way those things worked out. But now with Perseverance, well, Curiosity, of course, went up, and they had a much more advanced system. But even Curiosity had to stop every now and then. It still does. They sent up software recently to upgrade it, because that thing was launched back, it landed on Mars in 2012. There is, 11 years later. So, they recently sent up software to improve on its navigation capability as well. But Perseverance, which only landed, 2.5 years ago, in the Jezero crater, was built from the start right here on Earth with all this capability, upgraded cameras, all kinds of advantages over Curiosity. And their software is just, phenomenal. So now when it makes a drive, I think its record is like 1,500 feet in one direction. But when it makes it a long drive like that, it doesn't have to stop every now and then to look around and say, oh, there's a crater here or a hill here, or, I'm going to go this way, that way. And it looks into the distance too, and it's able to make its own decisions. So you tell it, I want to go, X amount of feet, and this thing does it without stopping. Now it's got a couple of computers on board, so it's able to talk to the other computer. The computer looks at the information, navigation computer figures it out instantaneously, sends the information back to the main computer just drives along. It's got six wheels, each one is controlled by a motor, and off it goes. So read that recently, how good the people that worked on the software and the engineers that developed all this stuff, the technicians that put it all together. It's just a phenomenal piece of equipment, Perseverance. I always talk about the helicopter on a regular basis, but Perseverance is still at it, going strong. Any comments? WS2N. Here's another company I talked about, ABL. ABL is stands for nothing. We've actually looked it up. Dr. Roy looked it up for me, too. ABL basically stands for nothing. But it's the name of the company that is trying to launch rockets into space, relatively small rockets into space. They tried successfully so far, twice. Twice from Alaska, from the Kodiak, now they call it the Pacific Spaceport. I go by the old name, the Kodiak Spaceport. And both times failed, you know, having got off the launch pad, blew up early, you know, parts came down and to the wooded area. The second one, I think, made it almost to space, but didn't quite go that well. And then they tried again from Florida. They actually put a NASA satellite on board, and they were going to put it up. And they launched, and that didn't work out. That second stage failed. So, but ABL, you know, gave up with that, and they said, well, we're going to develop a bigger rocket, and we'll go from there. And they've been working on it for quite a while. I don't expect to launch anytime soon. But the Space Force got the bright idea to give them a contract. And they give them a $15 million contract. What they want them to do, they want them to be able to get a satellite ready real quick and be able to launch real quick. If the satellite comes in, Space Force wants them to put it on board within 24 hours and have this thing launch instead of waiting, you know, months and months for a launch. I've discussed this before. If it sounds familiar, they've just done this with company Firefly. Firefly has been more successful. They've actually, you know, put a rocket into space before, you know, one or two launches. So they got the contract to do this exact thing. And what they're told by Space Force, you got 6 months between now and 6 months from now. We're going to call you up one day, and we need this thing launched like in a couple of days. And sure enough, a week or two ago, they did exactly that. They called them up. And they said, get ready. And there's another company called Millennium that they're also dealing with. And their goal is to make up a satellite real quick, and they did it in days. Small satellite, and they shipped it to Vandenberg, California, gave it to, turned it over to Firefly. Firefly put it on inside the fairing, and off it went, and successfully put it into space. Satellite got operating, which is an important thing for Space Force, or, you know, the defense industry. Story goes that, you know, you could take an adversary, some country that decides to, you know, knock one of our satellites out of space, especially a spy satellite, or, you know, we need something replaced real quick. Just that they decide to knock us out, no problem. 24 hours later, here's another one back. You know, I hope you got more satellites to knock us out, because, you know, we're going to beat you hands down. So I think it's a great program. It's going to deter any adversary from thinking about knocking out satellites out of space. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. I just want to talk about this one. I should save this to next week or so. I think Wesley likes this topic. I think Wesley likes the topics of cell phones, being able to contact, you know, use a spacecraft. It ran out as a spacecraft that was launched a short time ago, and it's got this antenna, big rectangular thing. It's not a, you know, parabolic antenna or anything like that. It's a flat massive antenna, about 26 feet by 26 feet, over 600 feet square feet of space. And it's a phased array system, so you could see a signal on Earth, and it could direct it and pick up that signal a little bit better. It could it could track that signal if the satellite is moving through space. And what they did is it's designed for cell phones. So I remember this topic many, many times. You know, is there any cell phone that could be used for space, you know, through a space satellite that could go into, you know, your domestic system? You know, they have, you know, military has had it for years. But, you know, is there anything that you use a regular cell phone, you know, no antenna that you pull out that would do this? And they did this the other day. They had some, one of the women, I guess, researchers that were involved in this. They put it on Hawaii, and one of the islands in Hawaii, with very little cell service. They said, okay, we're going to test this thing. So she had a Samsung phone, an S22 phone. That's one of the newer ones. I think they make the S23 now. I'm assuming it's for the year. Probably came out in 2022. But anyway, the S22 Samsung, you know, Android. And somebody answered it and set it up. The person answered it with Spain, and they had a 2-3 minute conversation. And they claim that's the first cell phone use that you can use through a satellite. And they're working on it, of course, expanding this idea. That was pretty. Any comments? I'll have to get the name of it. I just read this recently. I have to get the name of the satellite, and I'll find out. But, you know, 1, 2, 3. We'll probably talk about this again, I'm sure. But, all right, if somebody else has any comments, I guess we'll start to close it down. I closed it around the same time last week, around 10 o'clock. But any comments, you know, for the space network, actually for the TechNet this week, WS to win. Okay, I heard somebody key up. Anyway, we'll close it down. We'll be back next week. And anybody that's listening, we always have the Club Limelock InfoNet that comes on tomorrow, every Monday at 8:30. Not like this net always comes on at 8 o'clock, but 8:30, and that's always followed by George with the swap. And that's always followed amateur radio news line, which is always interesting. Is it? Like listening to that, there's always a space topic. Not always, but I would say 75% of the time they'll say, you know, start talking about the International Space Station or school making contact with them. I wouldn't be surprised if they talk about the OSIRIS-REx that just came flying through the atmosphere today. But we'll say 73. Thanks for everybody that listened. We'll turn the frequency back to normal radio and ham radio operation. This has been WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Roy, HC2GS, will be back next week at 8 o'clock. 73, WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, I tried to key up a minute ago and apparently was being covered by... something. I do have a couple of quick comments if you still have a minute or two. WB2BX.
Yeah, I heard that as well. I don't know what happened. Okay, yeah, WB2BX. Oh, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, okay. First of all, it seems like maybe you mentioned it and I missed it. It's that SpaceX is being delayed. They're supposedly technically ready to go, but the Fish and Wildlife Service is holding up their launch license, you know, because of the, you know, potential disruption to the wildlife refuge. Why anyone tried to build a spaceport on a wildlife refuge is a little beyond me, but then this is Texas. So I guess it's not strictly space. Apparently, Boom Aerospace is moving forward with its prototype for the eventual the newest version of a supersonic airliner, and they're actually apparently almost ready to flight test the prototype. I don't think anybody gave them any real chance of getting off the ground, but the project does seem to be moving forward. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. And I spoke to my brother. He follows the space program as well. Tonight he was talking about SpaceX with the wildlife problem. And, yeah, we both agree that, you know, he had to lose Texas. That's it. You know, pull out. Just build up Florida. You know, in Florida, you can launch anything you want over there. You know, they've been cleared to launch, you know, since before I was born. And, but I miss the company that's trying to develop the supersonic plane. Is this Boom, B-O-O-M, or is it a different one?
I think there was another one also. No, Boom Aerospace. They apparently have either a purchase order or a letter of intent from United to buy these things. Yeah, that's the one I was talking about. They have they're building a one or two seat prototype as a proof of concept, and apparently that's almost ready for its test flights. Go ahead.
Really, I haven't read anything about them lately. I knew they had dreams, and they would. I thought they, they could contract to build a whole bunch of these things. Yeah. Anyway, they're not going to be cleared to fly over land, though. They'll be going to Europe, you know. They got to be over the ocean. So this is different than the NASA Quest X-59 project that they're building that with, that'll just be one pilot. And their goal is to, we talked about this on the net before, too, that we'll fly over land and, hardly make any kind of a sound, you know, and then they'll scale it, be able to scale it up. Any other company would be able to scale it up if it works, and then you could have supersonic flights over land. But, yeah, I didn't know that Boom was close to doing it. I didn't even know they had an engine ready for that. Were they going to outsource that? Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, you know, I thought they were toast about a year ago. When Rolls-Royce declined to, I'm not clear exactly what happened. They either dropped out of the contract or declined to bid, or gave them a no bid on a contract to build their engines. And then I think they picked up in one of the podcasts that FTT, Florida Turbine Technologies, that builds jet engines for cruise missiles, took them up on it, and if I understand correctly, FTT is building the engines now. So I think building engines for that have to operate once to fly a cruise missile, as opposed to building airline engines that have to operate consistently for thousands of hours are two different things. But amazingly, these guys are moving forward. And I think the reason they feel there's a business case for this aircraft, even though maybe this ship is flying over the ocean, is that they believe they can build something with a range to fly the Pacific, which is what United really wants it for, as well as runs from Newark to London. They want to do Newark to London with this, and some runs across the Pacific. And they also have some contracts for these electric VTOL aircraft, new VTOLs, to fly people into the big airports to fly on this thing. So it's interesting if it happens. And this is a GA field. Handles big jets across the street from me, literally here in Northeast Philadelphia, and I'd love to be able to jump on an eVTOL there and go to Newark Airport, rather than have to go to New York to get on a long-haul flight or get an Uber and go to PHL here and fight the traffic on 95. go ahead.
You're considered an international airport over there, right? Down Philly, I think. I guess, that would, and Newark is a lot better than crossing over and trying to get to LaGuardia. LaGuardia's all built up. They modernized that now. It's real super looking. Very nice. Concorde, when the Concorde was here, I remember I took a flight to Ottawa. I went up to Ottawa. I remember coming back and they had the Concorde sitting on the runway in Kennedy when I came back. I said, oh, this is cool. I thought it was going to be such a great future. I think it was like 1975. I said, this is going to be great. I think by now these things would be, all over the place, but look what happened. And then a lot of times going to work, I'd be driving on the expressway. I would get close in Nassau. I'd be going into the city or maybe Brooklyn or something. And as I'm driving, if I looked up in the air and if I was late for any reason, maybe bad weather or something, I'd look up and I would see the Concorde coming in for a landing. That was really cool. It always came in, I think, around 9:15 or something, the morning. And I remember seeing that maybe a half a dozen times over the years. And then sure enough, it's gone. So to see another company, Boom, in this case, by the way, that's a god-awful name for any kind of an airline. I don't know what they're thinking. And why don't they just rename it Crash? Back to you, Frank. WS2X.
Yeah, and I do have to get going momentarily, and I suspect you do too. I do suspect at some point the PR people will make them change the brand name. I can certainly see the problem with that. Well, they're not the airline. They're the manufacturer of the aircraft, and supposedly their contract is with United to actually fly them. All this is still kind of vaporware at this point. Yeah, my brother, who's in the entertainment business, just flew the Concorde a couple of the times and absolutely loved it. Unfortunately, it just weren't enough people like him who could fly the Concorde for work to make it economically viable, I guess. The problem with it just didn't have enough range. Well, a lot of problems with it. Anyway, it is interesting. And you're right, PHL is an international airport. I haven't been through it all that much. There's an airport across the street from me, literally, across Grant Avenue here, PNE, or internationally designated KPNE, which is a general aviation field. I've been over there once with some of the Gulfstreams and Learjets and that kind of thing, as well as the little lawnmower planes operate out of. And they do not have any airline service, which is kind of frustrating since they're right across the street from here. We have to either go to PHL or go to New York or New York to go to an airport, and there's one right across the street. I do have to say Fern 3. It was, as usual, fun to get on here Sunday night. WB2BXM.
I'm glad you got on, Frank. As you know, I'm in Rock Hockham, so I get to see the planes fly very close to me. I can take them to MacArthur. What do we got? Southwest now. it's really cool to watch those things go. I get a big kick out of it. And I bring a flight aware, and I can see which flight is coming by. And, you know, if I'm in the backyard, I have a lot of fun with that. Anyway, 73 Frank, glad to speak to you, and hopefully we'll catch you next week. We'll be back. Hopefully, I know Roy will be back. He's off for the holidays. We'll be back next week. 73 Frank, have a good night. WB2BXL, WS2 and clear.
That time complete. W2BL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 1:55 a.m. Cloudy. Temperature 61 degrees.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
by Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.